All right, the lecture that we are going to engage in today is a lecture on the functional matrix. That is a concept that was developed by Dr. Moss. Now, Dr. Moss passed away about a year and a half ago after teaching in this school for 50 years and doing research. And he also was a graduate of the dental school here, and he was at some point also for 5 years its dean. So he is very much Columbia, as you might expect. And he, during his lifetime, developed the concept of the functional matrix, which has, in fact, become a very significant... Yeah, where is the light? All right, lights for conference. All right. Dr. Moss, when he developed this theory, the functional matrix theory, in the 60s and 70s, he literally caused a major change in the way we studied craniofacial size and shape, morphology, and growth. And so it is, I think, appropriate that I introduce this concept to you today as you are in the middle of studying the skull and its various components. Now, the concept of the functional matrix is based on the fact that we don't start by looking at the bones, but we start by looking at the functions that take place in the head and neck. And when you do that, you can... This box diagram is the one that we will use for this occasion. We will have an area of the skull that is the oral cavity, which is involved in digestion. That's one function. But it also is involved in respiration, although secondarily, and also it is involved in the final part of speech. And then we have the nasal cavity and the paranasal sinuses, primary function, is respiration, and there is olfaction, of course. The sense of smell is located there, and that takes up part of the area. The orbits are housing the organs of vision, the ears, the organs of hearing and balance. Of course, the cranial cavity, very important, contains the brains, and so that is the area where neural integration takes place. And so we can look at all of these various parts of the head and neck and say we can identify these functions, and we can identify the organs, the muscles, the blood vessels, the nerves that are associated with those functions. And so what you are now seeing on the side here, of course, is the more anatomically descriptive image of these similar functions. Now, what is the net effect of these different functions being present is that these organs are, in fact, housed in the skull, in the neurocranium. So you have the brain here, and you have the contents of the oral cavity here, the tongue, the teeth. You have some of the epithelia of the nasal cavity that we are looking at. And the skull now becomes a secondary structure. The skull is not primary. The skull is a secondary structure that protects and supports the organs and the muscles that are involved in performing these functions. So when you're saying that a skull is a secondary structure, you are now assigning it a secondary position, and that means that the shape of the skull and the growth of the skull really are dependent on the organs that are involved in the function. So let's look at that and try to understand that a little bit more. Here is another picture. What you have been doing in the past couple of weeks, you have been looking at the skull, and you've been looking at the various bones, and you're beginning to really understand all of that very well. But you haven't really looked at the contents. You have studied the concept that there are contents in the orbit, and you know a little bit about it. You know about the contents of the oral cavity. You know the muscles that are all present here. So you are aware that these structures are present, but you don't quite understand yet how they relate to the skull. And here's an older picture showing the same idea, which we can pass by. Now here is this nice exploded view of the skull that you have come to appreciate. And what you're seeing here are, in fact, the structures that you have primarily devoted your time on and your attention on. And now I'm going to ask you a question, because it is, in fact, an important question. How many frontal bones are there, folks? One, you say. And that's a correct statement for when the adult state. But in fact, the frontal bone is a pair of frontal bones that is fused. So, and it really fuses relatively late during the development. So it starts out as two frontal bones, and that is the statement. Okay? You have two frontal bones, they fuse. The same thing can be said for the vomer. The vomer is really formed by two bones that fuse relatively early in development, and therefore you think it's one single bone, but it really isn't. The same is true for the mandible. How many mandibles do we have? Two. They fuse in the area of the symphysis around birth. Okay? In some species, they don't fuse. When you look at a rodent, there are two mandibles, two hemimandibles you might call them, but they're really two mandibles. And when these animals are engaged in mastication, you can actually see how the two halves of these lower jaw are moving relative to each other. So the idea that the single bones that you study are in fact, quote, reality, is not quite true. Not quite true. And I'm now going to break these bones up for even more. Let me begin by showing you some examples. There is general agreement that the cranial capacity of females is slightly larger than the cranial capacity of males. So now, lest the females become a little happy, there is also a condition, especially in older females, of shrinkage of the brain. So in older females, the brain shrinks. And when the brain shrinks, now this happens to be in a male, but that is really rare, it's mostly in females. When the brain shrinks, as a result of the aging phenomena, you get something that's known as hyperostosis frontalis interna. What it means is that where the brain shrinks, the bone fills in. So all of this is kind of look like almost like lava. That bone fills in the space that was vacated, as it were, by the shrinking brain. And what you therefore see is a significant change on the inside of the bone. But now look at the outside. No change there, right? So what you can say is, hey, I have a frontal bone in this case, or you might have a parietal bone, where the inner surface, responding to the changes in the brain, has changed itself, but the outer surface has not. Let's look at some more. Here's another one. This happens to be now a female. Again, this is hyperostosis frontalis interna. It's more than frontalis. In fact, there's a little bit more going on. This happens to be in a female. And there is also some mineralization of the dura mater. So it's really, it's a mess. There's a lot of loss of volume here. And again, what you're seeing is that the inside surface has followed the shrinking brain and has produced more bone tissue. And this is found time and again. This is a diagram of a condition like this. Again, shrinkage of the brain on the right-hand side. And what you're seeing now is that the inner plate of the frontal bone kind of moved in all the way here. And you see something else, and that is that when there was this much space between the inner plate and the outer plate, which is remaining unchanged, that something filled in. Those are actually outgrowths of the frontal sinus. The frontal sinus, like any other sinus, will expand to fill available space. So that's something else that you're seeing here. So we have now identified the fact that within a single bone, even if you consider the frontal bone consisting of two halves, so one frontal bone on the right and one frontal bone on the left, you can already see that the frontal bone can be further divided. All right, let's see how good your image recognition is. What am I looking here at? Huh? Just speak up a little bit, I don't hear you. Frontal sinus, which makes this what, this area? This is the orbital surface of the frontal bone, and this would be anterior cranial fossa, right? So, and what you're seeing in between is what you saw before. You see an area where the frontal sinus has expanded. Same thing, but no frontal sinus. Same thing, no frontal sinus. Now, look at all of those structures and all of those diagrams which represent normal condition, normal variations of the theme. These are all human. And what you're noticing is that if the brain and the orbital contents are close together, there's very little bone present here. When they are further apart, as in this case here, there is more bone, and in fact there's so much bone that actually, again, there was space for the frontal sinuses to expand. So, what we now can say is, okay, one single bone, in fact, can be broken down, and it is very simple bone. The frontal bone is not a difficult bone to study. But what you're seeing here, you have, in fact, three parts to any bone, flat bone of the skull. And that is an inner cortical plate. There is an outer cortical plate. And then in between, there is a diploid. And now if we can say, okay, so these different parts of the skull, of the bone, in fact respond to different functional structures. The brain, in the case of the inner cortical plate. The diploid is responsive to bone marrow, and also, if it is present, a sinus. Sinus can grow in there, as we saw. And the outer cortical plate responds to structures on the outside, mostly muscles. Okay? So now we have identified the fact that we can, in fact, break down a single flat bone into three structures that relate to three different functional groups of tissues. Let's look at that some more. This is a very interesting experiment. It happens to be done on sheep, and so the jaws look a little funny. They were done in Czechoslovakia, and the experiment was a simple one, and that was that parts of the temporalis muscle were removed in that sheep. Never mind the bottom picture, which is no relationship to the other experiments. It is actually related to the next experiment. And what you're seeing here is that if you remove a lot of temporalis muscle, so we remove that, you see that there is a decrease in the coronoid process. Compared to the contralateral side, you see that the coronoid process has significantly decreased. And a little bit less removal of temporalis muscle, you still see a decrease of the coronoid process. And even less removal, there's still a slight reduction in the coronoid process. So it is clear that the presence of the temporalis muscle is in fact important for the size of the coronoid process. And the same thing can be said for the angle of the mandible. Now, what muscles are related to the angle of the mandible? You know that already? Yes? No? Yeah. Okay, you say yeah? masseter on the outside. Buccinator nut. No, no, no. Buccinator is really attached to pterygoid, medial pterygoid muscle. Okay? So you have an medial pterygoid masseter on the outside and on the inside medial pterygoid. Actually, the two muscles form a sling that literally, with a tendon in between, that surrounds the angle of the mandible. And again, when you remove parts of those muscles, or all of those muscles, what you end up with is a mandible without an angle. The angle is gone. Now let's look at the opposite experiment. This is actually a pathological condition, but it shows the same concept. This is a radiograph from my old professor of orthodontics way back in Holland, in the prehistoric times. And the patient presented, and when they took a picture in a frontal projection, what they saw was that the angle of the mandible flared very substantially. Big angle of the mandible. And they did all sorts of tests, you know, oral surgeons being what they are. Obviously, there's pathology there, so we're looking at the bone. It's probably a tumor. You know, the fact that it was bilateral didn't deter them. And so they looked at it and said, no, there was no tumor there. It looked like perfectly normal bone. And so then they decided to measure the activity of the masseteric muscle. And what do you know? The activity of the masseter was enormous. Hyperactive muscle. The muscle was substantially enlarged. And the decision was, well, clearly the masseteric muscle produced the angle of the mandible, this enormous structure. So what do you do? Well, the surgeons felt more comfortable with the idea of removing the bone. Let's just shave off the bone and make it normal again. Okay? That was fine. The patient looked great. They put all of the muscles back in the skin. 6 months later, the patient presented again. Same flaring mandible. Okay? What you learn is that the condition of the bone was caused by the hyperactivity of the muscle. Therefore, clinically, what you should do is not touch the bone. You should touch the muscle. Resect some of the muscle. That's what they did the next round, and the patient has been fine ever since. So there are two important points that you have heard here. One is that the loss of a tissue like this, and we're now going to introduce the concept, a loss of a functional matrix, and a muscle can be a functional matrix, a brain can be a functional matrix. A loss of such a functional matrix, and therefore the loss of its function, will lead to the loss of the related bone tissue. You saw that by removing of the temporalis muscle, the coronoid process that is produced by the presence of the temporalis muscle, in fact, is lost. You saw it by the removal of the masseter and the medial pterygoid muscle. When you remove those muscles, the angle of the mandible is lost. It is a direct response, therefore, to the presence of those muscles. And then you saw the second point with that case of the patient, that an enlarged functional matrix, which may result in increased function, will cause the development of more bone tissue. Okay? So there seems to be a very direct relationship between the tissues that are identified as the functional matrix and the related skeletal tissues. Now, the concept then is one that we shouldn't look at the individual bones of the skull as entities in themselves, but perhaps we should look at the bones and see what particular functional matrices are affecting these bones and whether those bones, in fact, are to be broken down in smaller units, which are going to be called microskeletal units. And this has enormous clinical importance, and therefore we will spend a few moments of your time on it. The concept of such breakdown of different areas within the single bones that you have come to know started out in a number of groups, including the Columbia group. James Henderson Scott in Ireland did this, and he called it the craniofacial regions. And when you look at that, and you have to kind of look at the key on the side, which is not as clearly shown, this is this projector is really poorly working. This would be the buttress region, so this area right here that has this kind of vertical hatching is the buttress region, the basic unit of the mandible, if you wish. And then there is an area that you call the muscular region. So this is muscular. That is the angle of the mandible. This is muscular. And then indeed there is an area that can be associated with the oral cavity and the presence of the bone, of the teeth rather. And that is the alveolar process. So the alveolar process is related to the presence of the teeth. And so you can go and analyze each individual bone and see whether you can identify separate functional regions to it. Now, this was done also by engineers based on the loading patterns and the strains in the skull. They found the same kind of thing. There was an area related to teeth. There was buttress areas. There were areas where the loading was directly conveyed. So this was all very nice. This is a very lovely picture. It all happened at the same time. People all started looking at the same thing. And so what you're seeing here again, this is kind of the basic, the basal unit of the mandible. Here is an area that is related to muscles. This is the alveolar bone. So that was an idea. And so the functional matrix arose within this intellectual climate in which people really were ready to start talking about the breakdown of these various bones of classical osteology. And so we have the diagram that is related to the functional matrix theory, where you see the actual breakdown of the skeletal units in the mandible. And you can now clearly see the coronoid process here, which is related to the temporalis muscle. You see the condylar process, which is related to the lateral pterygoid and the function, lateral pterygoid muscle, and the functional articulation, two things that are involved in that. There is an angular process responding to the masseter and the medial pterygoid. And then there is the basal part of the mandible that contains the neurovascular bundle. And finally, there is the alveolar process that is related to the presence of the teeth. Now, this is a very important point. You are going to find out, this is kind of basic dentistry, folks. You're going to find out that when you extract a tooth, when you lose all the teeth, the alveolar process is gone. It is lost. So the alveolar bone depends on the presence of the teeth. The teeth are therefore the functional matrix of the alveolar bone. Even though they are mineralized tissues, the teeth are considered the functional matrix of the alveolar bone. The same way the temporalis muscle is considered the functional matrix of the coronoid process, and the other muscles, masseter, medial pterygoid, the functional matrix of the angular, and the neurovascular triad is the functional matrix of the basal unit of the mandible. I haven't even looked on the inside yet, because the genial tubercles, of course, are another skeletal unit related to the muscles that attach to the genial tubercles. And then you can do the same thing for the maxilla. Okay, I'm going to show you that again. This is related to the orbit and the presence of the orbital mass. This part is related to the maxillary sinus. This part is related to the teeth, alveolar process. So that's the teeth that are important here. This is related to the nasal cavity. is therefore involved in the respiration function. And finally, here again is the basal unit, and that contains the infraorbital nerve and the accompanying blood vessels. And you can look further at the oral surface of the maxilla. And what you now see is, of course, the alveolar process, again, related to the teeth. And then you're seeing here the parts of the maxillary process, the palatal process, that are found between the nasal cavity and the oral cavity, and therefore are functionally, again, subdivided between the oral functions and the nasal functions. This has all very important clinical ways of thinking that follow from it, because when you are going to see a patient with a cleft palate, a cleft lip, but mostly with a cleft palate, this part of the bone may be absent, but the rest of the maxilla may be perfectly normal. Okay? So these are things that you have to keep in mind as you go along. And this, of course, is the classical picture of an elder person who has, in fact, lost all teeth, and you see what is left of the maxilla. There is, in fact, no alveolar process anymore. Very difficult to construct a full denture. Okay, that's one reason why implants were born. So maxillary process here is gone because the teeth are no longer present. Same thing is true here. And, of course, you get a typical profile of an older individual. Okay, now, philosophically, the concept of functional matrix, as I already have shown you, does inform us what to do for the patients in many cases. And I showed you the case of the flaring angle of the mandible as a result of mesenteric hypertrophy. But here is another case. This is a case of a patient that presented some years ago at the medical center at NIH in Bethesda, and the oral surgeon that looked at it saw that on the right-hand side of that mandible of this child at 5 years of age, the morphology was like this, and on the left-hand side, the morphology was normal, like this. Now, this was a very intelligent man, and they said, well, let's not do the surgery. It takes something for an oral surgeon not to do the surgery, but he did. And he followed the patient, gave the patient very careful suggestions for exercising the mandible. And I will not go to all of the intermediate stages, but without surgery, at 12 years of age, that child had grown the correction on the right-hand side of the mandible. Okay? That was specific exercises, most likely, I'm not aware of precisely what exercises he gave him. He never specified that in the literature. But the point is that undoubtedly it did involve the lateral pterygoid as well as the masseter and the medial pterygoid. And so the fact that you can intelligently design exercises to help the child correct this discrepancy between left and right, I think is a major achievement in the treatment of a patient. So, with this first introduction, let's now just briefly give you the outline of the functional matrix hypothesis. And that is that the functional matrix hypothesis, indicated here as FMH, is a phenomenological description of growth. Doesn't tell you how it happens, it just tells you what happens. So the phenomena that you observe as a result of the presence of functional matrices is described, and that's really what the hypothesis is all about. So we identify in the head and neck a series of functions: vision, speech, respiration, hearing, digestion, neural integration. Those are the functions that we identified on the diagram when I started out. Now, for each function, you can say that the function determines form, the form of the skeleton. And what you find is that you can, in fact, take the following. a functional cranial component. A functional cranial component is the functional matrix, the structures that perform the function, plus the associated skeletal units. So together they form the component, and what you can really say is, you look at the skull, it's built up of a series of functional cranial components. Each component has the functional matrix and a skeletal unit that is associated with it. Now there are two types of functional matrices. That is just to make you all more confused. The two types of functional matrices are periosteal matrices and capsular matrices. Now, until now, what I have spoken to you about are periosteal matrices. These are matrices that affect their related skeletal unit by causing resorption and deposition. So that is active growth, and that is active growth is occurs as a result of resorption and deposition. Okay? And what happens is that it changes the shape of the skeletal unit. It changes the shape of the skeletal unit. Now, there is another type of functional matrix, and that is known as the capsular matrix. In concept, it is not very difficult, but there are easy examples and there are not such easy examples. Easy examples are the orbital contents and the brain, the contents of the neural skull. The capsular matrix is the brain or the orbital contents. And the growth of these structures, the growth of the brain, the growth of the orbital contents, cause the bones that surround them to passively move in an outward direction as the soft tissues grow. Passive growth, and it results in a relocation of the bone. Okay? And so as the brain grows, the bones of the neurocranium kind of float apart. There are different analogies that you can make. You can say a capsular matrix is like a sandwich, a cheese sandwich. Okay? You have two pieces of bread, a little cheese in between. This is the traditional American sandwich. And how do you move the piece of cheese? You don't have to touch the piece of cheese. You take the two pieces of bread, you move it to your face, and you eat it, right? So that is passive motion. The cheese goes for a free ride. And that is what happens. The cheese, in this case, is the bone of the neurocranium. Okay, so that is what we call passive growth. There are other ways of describing it. We used to describe it by going and onto an escalator. You know, you stand on an escalator, you don't have to walk. I mean, walking a stair would be like resorption and deposition. You actually have to actively move. But if you go on an escalator, all you have to do is get on the escalator and you just go just like that. Okay? That is passive. That is passive growth, and you get relocated. Okay, let's move on. The total growth of the head and neck is a combination of active and passive growth. Active as a result of the periosteal functional matrices and passive as a result of the capsular matrices. That is a total growth. Now, what are functional matrix types that you can call periosteal functional matrices? The muscles are really good examples of it. So the periosteal functional matrix, muscles are a good example. What you find is active growth, resorption and deposition, and what is changed as a result of active growth is the size and or the shape. Okay? Straightforward, and of course these muscular processes of the mandible are excellent examples of it. What is a good example of a capsular matrix? The brain is an excellent example of a capsular matrix. The bones experience passive growth. The passive growth is not as a result of deposition and resorption. And what happens is it is passively moved from one place or the other to the other, and so the location is affected. Okay, this is the mantra of the functional matrix hypothesis. Look at it carefully. It is going to be posted, so you don't have to worry about it. But that says the whole thing in one very complicated sentence, okay? And Dr. Moss loved complicated sentences. He wrote them very complicated. And we always said, just talk. You're much clearer when you talk. But anyway, the origin, the development, and the maintenance of all skeletal units are secondary, compensatory, and mechanically obligatory responses to the temporarily and operationally prior demands of related functional matrices. It's a very complicated sentence, okay? I have worked with him for 40 years. I have been his wife for almost as long. And I'm, to this date, I don't remember this sentence by heart, okay? but what it means is that skeletal units do not develop unless there is a functional matrix present. That skeletal units do not grow unless the functional matrix that is associated with it grows. And that skeletal units do not remain unless the functional matrix remains. Example, the presence of teeth. Okay? So the maintenance in being is therefore... Okay. It is... The skeletal units are therefore secondary. They are responses. The changes in the skeletal units are responses to whatever prior demands the related functional matrices are putting on the skeletal units. So it's really a straightforward statement if you understand the basics. Okay, now let's just for a moment go into the rather complicated situation of the growth of a skull. And we give a whole course to the postdoctoral residents in the specialty programs on this particular subject. So I trying to do it in 1 hour is a little unfair, but it's okay. What you're seeing here in this particular diagram, if you look closely, there is a little outline of a newborn skull. And what we're saying is this newborn skull has got to go from here to here, okay? That's the growth that has to take place. And you can look at the growth that occurs and say, well, how does it happen? How does it develop? Well, let's first look at the neurocranium. And what you're seeing here is the diagram of the newborn. Here's the newborn. Here is the adult. And so what you're now seeing is that as a result of the growth of the brain, remember that's a capsular matrix, the bone that originally was located here, let's just look at this parietal bone, for example, it is now being passively carried to this position. And if nothing else happened, we would have a major problem. Okay? So we need to adjust by the function of periosteal matrices, and the brain also secondarily acts as a periosteal matrix. What you find is that as this bone is being carried to this position right here, there is compensatory growth on this side and on this side for the brain, for these bones to keep in touch in the suture. So sutural growth, the growth of the suture, is secondary to the translation of the bone to this new position. Literally makes up more bone to keep the two bones in articulation with each other. The same thing happens here where there is another suture. Okay? And so what you find is this is secondary compensatory growth. Very important. If that didn't happen, and you sometimes see it in a child where there's a lot of cerebrospinal fluid being produced, you get hydrocephaly, huge head. Unless you drain that fluid, that excess fluid, the skull becomes very enormous, and it is a potentially very dangerous condition. So here you have the idea. What happens if we just have the passive motion of the bone? You get this. Okay? But what you need to do is to add more bone here at the suture. The muscular activity produces more bone in this direction, and you get also the dura mater that stimulates more bone in this direction. So there are these additional periosteal activities that change the shape of the bone. So any growth in a capsular matrix environment is a combination of passive growth, but then there is also secondary compensatory periosteal growth. Okay, which is active. Now, the brain is an easy subject because, okay, well, you know, you can understand it. You say it's a mass of tissue and you can see how it grows. The concept becomes a little harder when you think about the nasal cavity and the oral cavity and the pharyngeal cavity, because those cavities are spaces. They are air-filled spaces. And so now, how do you think about that? And of course, the important thing that you have to remember is that the very fact that there is a patent space is in fact what makes that space function. Think about it. Try to occlude your nasal cavity and your oral cavity. You can't breathe. You're not going to live very long, okay? So the very patency of that space, in fact, is the functional part of that space. And so we have termed those as functioning spaces. And the functioning spaces grow in relation to the demands of the body for increased respiration. In fact, the functioning spaces and the lung growth can be seen to be correlated, corresponding with each other, and usually are in advance of major increases of muscle mass. So that there are data to actually support what seems to be a far-fledged concept. So, but you can think about these functioning spaces, nasal, oral, and pharyngeal together, as a set of expanding balloons. And what grows here, interestingly, is the oral mucosa and the nasal mucosa. It is the epithelium that grows and enlarges the space, and then secondarily, passively carries the mandible in this position. And so when we're talking about capsular matrices, we include the capsular matrices around the brain, we include the brain, which is the capsular matrix. We include the orbital contents, and we include the oronasal and pharyngeal functioning spaces, all as capsular matrices. Just to make you aware that the capsular matrices are not just in the head and neck area. The body cavities that you are seeing here, very graphically illustrated, are also capsular matrices. And the growth of the skeletal elements around them in a similar way are affected by the concept of the functional matrix. This is the last picture I want to show you. And essentially, this is a picture that was prepared by a colleague of Dr. Moss's, and we kind of liked it. Basically, it shows the various capsular matrices and the way they expand, the brain, the oronasal and pharyngeal spaces, and you see how they all, as they are expanding, are producing the kind of passive growth of the skeletal elements, and of course the related remodeling to preserve the shape of those skeletal elements in a very meaningful way. Okay, this is a first introduction into this concept of the functional matrix. In fact, you will find, for example, in Stedman's, it has its own entry now. You can, in fact, find it and see it described. If you're going to be an orthodontist, on your board exams, you're going to get questions on functional matrix. Okay, this is a concept that really has become well embedded in the anatomical and clinical literature. In the next course that you are going to have from me, and Dr. Yuan, we are going to talk some more about it, and we're going to talk more of the tissues that are involved in the growth of the skull, and we'll revisit some of these concepts that I introduced to you today. But I hope it will allow you to start thinking about the skull in a less mechanical, statical way, but start thinking about the functions that are associated with it. Thank you very much.